This is St. Pete X, affectionately known as SPX. SPX brings you St. Pete's brightest business people, civic leaders, and citizens who share their insight and expertise as well as their love of our great city. SPX is presented by the St. Petersburg Group. Head to stpete.co to check out more episodes, and by St. Pete's most effective marketing agency, Big C. Browse to bigc.co to see their work. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is Steve Tingaris. Welcome, sir.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I noticed is that you've run startups. You've done the grind for many, many years, and you look fantastic. You're cut. You got muscles. You look healthy. How did you survive? Tell me, what's the secret?
You don't have much time to eat, you know, and you're always running.
Starvation, to the next health thing. Diet. Yeah.
It's survival of the fittest out there, I guess. I don't know. No, but I appreciate that. I try to stay healthy for, the energy. It takes a lot of energy.
That's right. So let's run through the companies. You've had a very good track record. I met you back when I was playing around with SavvyCard, and you were with Prospect Sparter, which kind of evolved. And so let's just get a catch up of the journey through the companies.
So Prospect Sparter is still around, and Enthusen.com. I exited the company in January of 2014. And since then, immediately when I exited with all kinds of ideas of other things that I want to do, which I think is probably typical of the way that most people do it. I wasn't ready to retire by a long shot. So I started a company, Dabble Lab, that the first incarnation of it was, I guess the buzz term at the time was Startup Studio. And the idea was we'd put together an engineering team and we'd work on like different products that we thought we could spin out into companies. And so I took these ideas and worked on them and thought, they'll be great. And I'll find a CEO and we'll have like this portfolio of companies and great CEOs. Long story short, that didn't work at all.
So all the original ones were you were just trying to spin up your own companies. You weren't doing it as a service.
That's right. Yeah. I'm sort of on my third revision of Dabble Lab.
Okay.
But revision one was, I'll call it the startup studio model, where we were going to launch startups from this shared engineering team. We did launch a couple of products. They just didn't really go anywhere. And mostly, I think the model was failed. And like, I thought that maybe I could sell other people on these ideas that I thought were great. And I would go out and try to do that. And the response I would get was, yeah, that's a good idea, but listen to my idea. You know, my idea is way better than that one. At least from the people that I was trying to get interested in running the companies. And that sort of gave way to the second iteration of Dabble Lab, which was, okay, I'm not having much luck selling my ideas to anybody. Maybe I just need to buy into their ideas. And so the next version of it was, so I ended up investing in some startups and we became their engineering team. So the next version was kind of, you bring the idea to us, you know, we'll build it for you and we'll become partners. You run the business side, we'll take care of the tech and engineering side. And ended up with a portfolio of about 14 companies there.
You had equity in all of these.
Yes, and still do for the ones that are still around. But the reality for us with startups is under the best circumstances, launching a successful startup takes a lot of work. And having good tech alone is not enough. And for that matter, having a good idea alone is not enough. I mean, you need the right people, you need the right timing, you need capital, you need all of these things. And so we kind of, through that process, learned that the one thing that we were able to do pretty well was share a common R&D team across, you know, multiple organizations. And that piece was working pretty well. But the stage of the companies that we were working with really couldn't afford to fund the team. And so without an exit or, you know, an influx of capital from any one of these companies, it really wasn't a viable model, at least the Dabble Lab piece of it. But what did come out of it is we had a couple of external companies that we engaged in a conversation with that started off as an equity kind of arrangement, but they didn't need the
services.
Well, they needed the services, but they didn't need to give away equity.
Got it.
So they're like, how about we just pay you? Mm-hmm. And that is most of what we're doing today with Dabble Lab. But what's different about what we do is we're very narrowly focused on emerging technologies and more specifically artificial intelligence and machine learning and in the digital assistant space. So we're helping companies leverage Amazon Alexa, you know, Google Assistant, Twilio Autopilot, Microsoft Cortana, and there's a host of other ones out there for business applications and might be business to consumer where these devices are acting as sort of the front end to your brand. People are beginning to get savvy about how these things fit in organizational context, you know, for business and certainly in homes. There's, I think last year or the last couple of years, over 60 million of those smart speakers, they call them. But the speakers themselves are not all that smart. They really just relay what the user's saying to a smart backend. And so the technology is finding its way into just about every imaginable device out there. And so the industry is starting to get some legs under it. And that's been good for Dabblab. So now we're almost exclusively focused on just building bots and digital assistants for business.
Not a bad place for it to end up, a successful business, you know, just a little bit of a roundabout way to get there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that it's just kind of how it works. I mean, with any company, part of the name, you know, the Dabblab, and the reason I chose that name is because like the one thing that stays consistent with technology is that it's constantly changing. And you really don't know what the next thing is going to be. You know, like you might have some ideas, but if I had bet on who the winner was in, you know, the web world back in the 90s, I would have said for sure that Yahoo would be running everything, you know, and Netscape Navigator would be right next to them. And I don't know, Real Networks might be the Real Networks.
And IE just threw in the towel, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you just don't know. Yeah. And the winners change and can change, you know, like within years and technology changes. So you really have to be dabbling with a lot of different things and understanding it to some degree to hopefully recognize where an opportunity might be or where a trend might be going. And then where you do find something that might be an opportunity, then you really need to get scientific about it and really dive in. And that's where the lab part comes in. So my idea was initially, I need to find a way to dabble with emerging technologies and figure out which ones could be leveraged into opportunities, business opportunities. And it's sort of what we do today.
Yeah.
It's just, we do it for other businesses. So lots of businesses today, every business is to a certain degree, a technology business.
So are you selling it as, you know, here's what we want and you build it? Or are you also selling the creativity piece of it, the actual experimentation piece?
Yes, in some cases, but our engagement model has really shifted to be almost an on-demand R&D team. And what our clients do, the literal engagement model, is they buy fractions of the team. So we have teams of 3 to 5 people. We've got multiple teams. And we have, for every team of 3 to 5 people, we've got 5 to 7 clients that contribute to sponsor that team.
Right.
And those clients might be using, you know, a few thousand hours a year. You know, it just depends on where they are. But the challenge that we've been trying to overcome for our clients is today, every company to a certain degree needs to be a technology company, because to stay competitive today, you need to have technology know-how. But not every company understands how to create technology products. They don't write code. And so we're sort of fitting that gap. If you're a company that needs technology R&D, but you don't have a technology R&D department,
right,
that's sort of where we fit. And if you're not quite to the stage where it makes sense to hire a team of 5 people, you can buy into a fractional team that you share with non-competitive partners. Or they're not really partners. They're other companies that also share the same team.
All right, so you went through a couple of the iterations for Dabble, and there's a couple of questions or things I wanted to explore in each of them. So first, going back to the initial one, an interesting ask to basically look for a founder or a startup type that's not already attached to a startup. So, you know, in general, you know, you said that they were attached to their ideas, and, you know, beyond that, did you find any candidates? I mean, was there any play in the, you know, recently retired fractional C-level space that could come in, and or did it have to be youth? And with the youth, was it really the driver about it being their idea? Well, you know, did you find any successful candidates to come in and run a company?
No, I found successful candidates for sure. None that were willing to do what I was hoping to get them to do.
From an effort standpoint or from a skill standpoint?
Well, there's definitely people out there from a skill standpoint, but those people tend to want to drive their own idea more so. And on the other end of the spectrum, I could go out and just hire somebody, but the people that I talked to that would be straight up, you know, hires where, you know, the income requirements would be commensurate with their skill and what they needed. The ones that I talked to, I just didn't feel the entrepreneurial drive that I thought would be necessary for a company at that stage.
Right.
Certainly as a company matures, you know, you've got those kinds of roles, but these were just straight up like ideas
right,
that had very early minimally viable product behind them and sort of a roadmap from how to get from zero to someplace.
You're in the fractional services business now. Did you feel like you needed a singular champion, or did you feel like you might be able to do three or four of these by committee with a team, or did you think about that angle?
I personally think that for a company to succeed, there needs to be a full-time dedicated champion, like one person that wakes up and is thinking about it, goes to sleep and is thinking about it, and really puts everything into it, that, you know, they've got to be passionate about it. I think in the absence of that, the chances that you really succeed are, I don't see it.
To get very lucky.
There might be some examples of it that I can't think of, but I was really looking for somebody that just would really buy into it. And that's not something that I was finding.
You were not just looking for one of those. You were looking for several of those to make the model work.
I really underestimated. Like, I thought I'd be, you know, be able to go out and, you know, and find people who'd be like, oh, this is great. I, you know, I really wanted to find something that I could get behind and just run. And I think that's different today too. Also, like today, everybody's technical. Not everybody writes code, but everybody understands what potential there is for technology. And so, you know, as we're using apps, we think, oh, wow, you know, if we could take this same general thing and use it over here, we could do this and this and this. And so I think just overall, when I first got started in business, you know, as a technical founder, I guess a big part of what I was doing was educating people on what was possible, you know, and getting them excited about that. But today it works differently. Today people come to me and go, look, we could do this, 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 and this. We just need to know how to code it.
Right.
So I think it's just a different time. And I sort of learned that through this process, or maybe I knew it, but didn't pay as close attention to the nuance that I should have.
And how to expose it too, because that's, you know, getting an audience, and especially those ideas that really need a nationwide critical mass to work, that's a very expensive prospect nowadays. So moving into the second phase then, that, you know, with the founders now that are coming to you, now you're still playing in that space, but you're saying, okay, I'll acquiesce and go with your ideas. At this point, they have some money, but it's mostly an equity engagement for you. And so, you know, given that, you know, I especially can't imagine the load balancing, right? So you have a team, maybe there's an idea that you see a real potential for a good exit, but they don't maybe have the resources. And then you have the other one that's not as keen on, but they have the resources. And then did you get into every situations where you were trading equity back and forth between the companies to load balance the work, or how did you manage that?
Yeah, and that's a big part of why for us, the second iteration really didn't work either. It's very tough to load balance because at the center of all this, you also have an organization, and the organization needs to pay for the engineers and, and everything else. And so you do end up sort of in a scenario where you've got to go, okay, you know, we don't love where they're going with this, but they just raised some funding on it. So, you know, they get a bigger slice of the team because
they can pay for it.
They can pay for it. But that didn't happen enough, actually. Like, that probably would have made the model work better, but there wasn't enough cases where they raised enough money to trump everybody else. So it was mostly trying to democratically, in some cases, work with what they had, which was in many cases, you know, not as much as they needed. And, you know, without raising funding, it's tough.
You're essentially putting yourself in the middle of 6, 8, 10 champions all grabbing at you from different directions with a lot of passion. That's got to be a tough spot to be
in. Yeah, it was a tough spot to be in. And it's especially tough because to do it at all, you kind of got to buy into the person and to their ideas. So personally, I really liked all the ideas and I really liked all the people. And then you get to the point where you're just completely out of bandwidth, you know, like personally, you know, financially and capacity wise. And just like when you're running a business, I mean, at the end of the day, you got to make something happen. Like in our, you know, our, I don't know, line in the sand, I suppose, but what I tried to make clear is our role is concept to capital, meaning that, you know, our purpose is to help you get to the point where you can raise capital to get it to the next stage. But the raising the capital part is on you. The getting the concept to the point that somebody understands what it does and they can see a minimally viable version of it. And, you know, maybe we can get some early market evidence that it's there. That's on us because that's, you know, what we bring to this, but you need to go out and find the capital.
And there's a lot more to that process than just engineering. So, you know, how wide did you go with your involvement in the companies from product design to even marketing or positioning?
So you kind of tend to go into things with rose-colored glasses a lot of times. So my thinking was we'd go into it and they'd carry the torch on the funding and the business side. And I could advise where my experience might be helpful, but that wasn't my role. My role was to, you know, head up the engineering side of it and product marketing to, you know, not head it up so much as like I have done a lot there, And I definitely would not call myself like an expert fundraiser or any of that stuff. I've been around it just because you can't not if you're an entrepreneur in tech, and learn some things as a result of that. And, you know, my involvement with Florida Funders and, you know, so I kind of understood it, but that's not what I do. You know, like that's not where I would call myself an expert, but you still kind of get pulled into all of these things and the line gets very blurry, like where your role stops and starts, and you just run out of time. And so you got to figure it out. And at some point you've got to say, hey, this isn't working, and or this is working, but it's not an easy.
You say you're not an expert at the raise, but I mean, you were in that scene when it was really hard, right? I mean, you were in a sense, you know, back with LumaStream and even, you know, SavvyCard, and those guys were trailblazing, you know, when it was a desert of investment. If you weren't a condo or maybe a hotel, then, you know, they couldn't understand the words that were coming out of your mouth.
Yeah,
you know?
So yeah. It's like, I still think to this day that the best way to raise money is to get customers.
Yeah.
And that even if you want to go out and get capital from investors, you're better off getting to the point where you don't really need it to stay alive.
Yeah.
You can use it as an accelerant to grow.
Sure.
And the guys and girls that I was kind of trying to align with were the ones that had a plan to get to, you know, some real paying customers in a short period of time. And then you could sort of leverage that to go, all right, you know, we do have a repeatable sales process, and we can go out and, you know, find, get, and keep customers.
And obviously, that somewhat depends on how capital intensive the stand-up is, right?
If
it's, you know, it's a huge, complex software build, and it makes it a little harder.
But. Yeah. And that went into the model for, you know, what was a fit and maybe what wasn't so much a fit. Like if the, you know, capital requirements were just way beyond, you know, like if you're going to build a hotel, and this is not software, but you can't rent the rooms out until the hotel's built. And if it's one of those kind of deals where you just got to invest the capital to get to that point, we weren't a fit for that kind of thing. We're looking for the, you know, what are the opportunities where we can build something that it's not as great as it should be, but good enough to get somebody to go, oh yeah, I'll bet on that. And that was the focus.
So you mentioned, you know, obviously the technology you're talking about now is right on it's on the cutting edge, and you're ahead of the curve. So what are your observations on the curve? You know, you talk about trends, and have you put a lot of time and thinking into what are trends, you know, what the genesis of trends are, and maybe even where in specific niche areas you might influence those trends?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I'm not sure about how to influence those trends. I'd love to know how to do that. But what spotting the trends, I think, is pretty important. And there's some that you don't need to be all that clever to spot. You know, like I think there's some big things happening now in tech that probably anybody that you would interview would probably mention if you said, what are the, you know, the coming things? And machine learning and artificial intelligence, obviously blockchain stuff, I think has a lot of potential. And I'm not just talking cryptocurrency, but blockchain stuff, augmented reality and virtual reality.
Some of that stuff has sort of come and crested and kind of come back a bit, you know, it needs a lot of improvement, but, you know, we were heading hard into augmented reality and sort of has been plateaued a bit, right?
And so, yeah. And I think that's how technology works. You know, you get some, how's that saying go? The pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the land. You know, like you get some people that will run in and make some headway, and the technology that underlies it maybe gets a little bit better, or economic conditions change, or something's different.
The right use for it, you know, comes out, and, you know, it's that lucky hit or the right publicity.
For sure. Yeah. Like with the machine learning stuff, the compute capacity is just so much, you know, what you can do today with neural networks, just at the price point, it just wasn't even there 15 years ago even. And a lot of that has probably been enabled by like Amazon Web Services and things like that, where, you know, a startup doesn't need to go and invest millions of dollars into capital hardware to, you know, figure out if this stuff can happen. And all of those kind of go into creating new opportunities.
So what are some of the areas in AI that you feel the most personal connection to that you really want to, you know, latch onto for the coming years?
Business automation. Businesses that don't adopt AI are going to find it increasingly challenging to stay competitive. And, you know, when you look at numbers like, well, the classic revenue per headcount, and you see those numbers going up where you used to be able to say, oh, you know, a $10 million company with, you know, that's in this industry, you know, they probably got 100 people or 120 people. And there was some sort of reasonable ratio of how much top line revenue they had per each employee. Well, that number is going way up. And I think in the coming years, you'll see billion-dollar companies with dozens of people. And what's going to enable that is technology, and more specifically, well, artificial automation and network effects. And the network, the plumbing is already in place. And this is, you know, the internet, of course, but social media and all of the APIs that have been out there to connect apps and things like that. Now, you know, all of that plumbing is in place. And with the machine learning and the AI on top of it, you're going to see companies that are just doing incredible things with not as many people as you would have expected. And there's already examples of it. They're kind of outliers now, but I think it's going to become commonplace and, you know, over the next decade.
I think of AI a lot of times as these chatbots and front-end stuff, but you're actually talking about back office things. So what are some examples of some back office services?
So one of the projects that we worked on started as a project to minimize the time that people were spending in team meetings. And it was for a company they had a development team and they would get together every day for like a stand-up, which is pretty common in the development world. And as they added members to the team, these meetings got longer and longer. And so to make the meeting more efficient, the first kind of thing that they did was they said, okay, you know, everybody come to the meeting with this information and be ready to just, you know, divulge this information so that we can go around really quick. And what we realized is that the information that they were collecting was stuff that we could create a bot to collect and analyze. So for example, how many commits they made to GitHub, you know, how many issues were coming up, you know, what people were saying about issues. So we created a bot that would go collect the information. And then during the meeting on the conference call, the bot, Alexa in this case, was the platform that we used. Alexa would tell everybody where they were. You know, this is what Joe's doing. This is what Susan's doing. This is what, and get through that process in, you know, a matter of minutes, where when you went around the call and had everybody do it individually, it took significantly longer and nobody had to go collect their information. You know, this was all 100% automated. And once we enabled that, the obvious next step was like, well, you know, if we can use the Alexa assistant to stay on top of where everybody is for product development, can we also do that for sales? And in this case, they had a pretty good size external sales team. And by external, they were contractors. They weren't, you know, employees.
Right.
So they really had no visibility into what the sales funnel looked like at all, because they couldn't make people use any one CRM. So we added to the digital assistant. So the assistant would just text people every so often and go, hey, how many meetings do you have lined up for this week? They'd text back 3, 5 or whatever. And of course, we would collect all that on the back end. So when the sales meetings happened, same thing. You know, this is how many meetings we had scheduled for last week, and this is how many of them closed. This is how many John has. Oh, and Mike never responds to my text messages.
Right.
You know, so I don't know what he's doing while it's on the call. And these are all functions that a sales manager would have to do. But in their case, they had 200 plus people,
right,
you know, and one sales manager that just physically couldn't do it, you know, couldn't do all the time. But to a bot, it's cakework.
And obviously you can easily apply business intelligence to it, crunch numbers or whatever. And did you get to a point where you were hybriding between manually receive stuff back, you know, the texts and whatnot, and the actual, any of the internal data that you could pull from the system?
Yeah. So like a great example of that, and one of the big differences between what you can do with a conversational assistant in AI versus like a traditional dashboard, right? Like if you look at a dashboard, you can see a bunch of numbers that pull out of systems, but unless you know what those numbers mean, those numbers aren't very valuable to you. So for example, if you're looking in an accounting system and it says, okay, you know, here's all of the invoices that are past due. Real quickly, aging on invoices, has that been increasing or decreasing? Well, I don't know. We need to create another report for that. Mm-hmm. All right. Once we do that, if aging is increasing, how does that affect our cash flow? I don't know. Let's do another report on that. Okay. If there's a negative effect on our cash flow, at what point will that cause us to need more capital? Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, how does that affect our cap table? Do we pay interest on that capital if we borrow it? How does that affect our profitability? You know, all of these things are things that would take somebody that has a lot of knowledge about the organization to sit down with a spreadsheet and gather lots of data, that we build a bot that just does it automatically,
right,
you know, and says, you know, hey, aging has been increasing by 2% over the past 3 months. That's a problem. If that continues at this point, we'll be out of cash. So somebody needs to get on this issue today, because it can't wait another 60 days. And the bot can do that. You don't need a human doing that.
Do you try to pre-build those queries, or was the AI able to use AI to, I guess, spot problems that maybe even a human wouldn't think to ask?
That's exactly right. So it's a combination of the two. So there's going to be algorithms that you would take from normal business processing. You know, so you would say, okay, Joe, you're the CFO. What kinds of things do you want to know about on a regular basis? And how do you get those answers today? And then you might say, well, I get data from here, 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 and here. You know, I put it in this spreadsheet and I run this formula, this formula, this formula. And if it looks like this, that tells me this. If it looks like that, that tells me that. So those are pretty easy. Those are just, you know, let's incorporate the logic. But the other things, to your point, that machine learning can do that, you know, we just don't do well as humans is look at massive amounts of data and recognize differences in patterns that we would never see. Like, for example, you've got an organization that has lots and lots of people that are submitting expenses. Is the types of things that they're submitting normal or not? Well, I don't know. Like, without going through every single solitary expense and looking for the, you know, the one case where, you know, somebody went someplace that they shouldn't and, you know, put it on their expense report. Machines can do that without, it's just really, really simple stuff. And if they don't know what it means, they can still bubble it up and say something like, well, you know, I don't know what this means, but I know it's not normal.
Right.
And those kinds of pattern recognition sorts of things. And it's fundamentally how machine learning works. So I get asked a lot, like, well, what is, you know, machine learning and how is it different than how we normally would do stuff? So normally with like semantic programming, it's mostly like if then, like if this happens, then do this. But with machine learning, it's more like training somebody, like a person.
Right.
So here's a bunch of examples of something. Now here's something new. Does this new thing that I give you look like those existing things? And the answer could be a definite yes, or, and it's actually never definite, could be, yeah, I think so, or no, I don't, with some degree of confidence. And so the more data you have, the degree of confidence is going to go up if the new case is like previous cases.
And I would assume also there's a lot of communication gaps between humans too. So, you know, somebody's actions in one department may never actually sit in the same meeting as another department. Or if they do, they're not, the infrastructure isn't there to communicate about this. A lot of the win can happen just from crossing communication gaps with data that don't get crossed with humans sharing that data.
Yeah, for sure. And we have bias, like there's cognitive bias, you know, and personal biases that machines just don't have. They don't care. They just tell you what's in the data.
Are there negatives to that? Is there a, you know, a benefit that comes from human interaction as it relates to productivity or as it relates to creativity or as it relates to, you know, inspiration to do certain things based on the stakeholders involved and their relationships back and forth that you lose with AI?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so you hear AI generally the topic of, oh, it's going to take jobs, it's going to come up. And it's not going to take jobs that are designed for humans ever. It will take jobs that humans aren't the best fit for all day long. And the reality there is that most of the jobs that AI is going to replace are jobs that humans really don't want anyway. They might get paid to do them today, but they're process-oriented jobs. And my optimistic side says, you know, if we can provide people with more time, they'll do things that are more valuable,
right?
You know, and they'll do things that are more human. And I think about things like, you know, 100 years ago, how long did it take to wash clothes?
Mm.
Right? I don't even know how to do it. Like, but I just imagine like somebody dunking clothes into a basin of water and, you know, wringing them out and hanging them. But it was hours of work. And today we, you know, take our dirty clothes, we throw it in the wash machine and pull it out of the washing machine, just throw it in the dryer. And we don't even really think about it. It's, you know, minutes. And that frees us up to do things that are more valuable.
Well, and you know, that's sort of the argument that goes around now is that it frees you up to kind of look at your phone, right?
Yeah.
And so when I say it's not, you know, not so much, wasn't thinking about the job replacement, but when you have a group of humans sitting around a table and the first order of business is to have this just black and white data laid out and then sort of be human after that. In theory, you're like, yeah, that's better data, right? And that's clear. It is black and white. But, you know, is there a piece of business and a piece of innovation and a piece of creativity that is hurt by that, by us being moved into that way of thinking?
For sure. This is all, you know, it's all new territory. Yeah. it's all dabbling. So yeah, for sure. I don't know. What I do know is that things are going to continue to evolve. Like, so technology is not going to stop. Or, well, if it does, we got much bigger problems. So we're going to have to adapt one way or another. And I also think that the capacity for human potential is unlimited. And, you know, there's always going to be problems to solve that require humans. And the more time that we have to problem solve, which is kind of what's unique about people, right? If we were cheetahs, we'd want to be running a lot because we'd be super fast. But we're creatures that solve problems. And if it's something that a machine can do, it's not really a problem anymore.
Right.
And so let's move on to the next thing. We've got lots of big issues to solve. Let's put more brain power on those.
So, I mean, but you're sort of, you have to be because of your industry, you're kind of a de facto futurist. So what about the concept of work and its necessity altogether? You know, have you thought about the whole, you know, universal basic income and the idea that, you know, should humans all have to work, or is our ultimate goal to go to a place where we don't have to if we don't want to?
I guess it depends on how you define work. So do all humans need to make an income to cover their expenses? Yeah, I think they do. Should all humans be doing something that is valuable? I think so also. Whether or not that's something that they get paid for directly in sort of the way that we think about it today is, I don't know. I think that we all need to be contributing, you know, to get the things that we individually want. And, you know, we'll want to hopefully work to better our community and, you know, all this, but it's all interrelated. I don't think we have a clear answer. In my opinion, it's not a like socialism versus, you know, capitalism sure. kind of thing anymore. That like there's this unclear new territory that we just haven't explored. So when we think of socialism, we think of the version of it that we've seen in history, which is not good.
Yeah.
And when we think of capitalism, we think of the version of it that we've seen to date, which is very good, you know, relative to what we've seen with socialism. But you can't stop there, right? You also got to think about what happens when you've got a change that really just kind of changes the fundamental building blocks of capitalism, right? So if you believe human capital is the building block of capitalism, right. which, you know, if you look at Adam Smith or
historically
anyone,
it was, yeah.
when the population got bigger, the GDP increased. And so it was all about just more people because more people were able to produce right. more things. What if that changes? How does that affect, you know, the building blocks of what we're relying on? And I certainly don't have the answer to that, but I think it's a question that we need to consider. I don't think it's responsible, maybe responsible is too heavy of a word, but I don't think we can assume that what's worked in the past will by default work in the future. And I think we need to be thinking about that objectively and, you know, with our problem-solving synapses firing, you know, I think it's something that we're going to have to address.
One of the dings on our current capitalism is the proclivity for wealth to be amassed by a very, very small number of people. And certainly technology has played, you know, obviously the Rockefellers and people who owned some of the big commodities back in the day were way wealthier, but the Bezoses and some of the people that own the companies that are their personal wealth is as much as three states worth of, you know, wealth is.
Yeah.
That's something that I think we're catching up with a little.
Again, this outside of my expertise, but my opinion or general thinking on it, I guess, is for most of modern history, the distribution of wealth has been very unequal. And, you know, the upper 1% has held the vast majority. And I think that goes back some time. And, you know, that might be changing more, but I'd like to think that at the end of the day, even the upper 1% are still human and they want to enjoy being human because no matter how much you have, your general path is not unlike everybody else's. You know, you're going to get to the end just like everybody else does. And so I would like to think that, you know, if they could choose, they would want to see a society that's not fair, you know, like, because it never is, but it's, you see good things happening and everybody can chase their dreams. And if your dream is to amass billions, go for it. You know, if your dream is to be really good at something that will never make you wealthy in the financial sense, but is what you're built for, go for it. Like that's hopefully something that continues to happen. And the Jeff Bezos thing, if, you know, if all of us are broke, who's going to buy stuff on Amazon?
Or even the flip side, you know, thinking about it a little more is that it's opened the door for anybody or more people to get to that. You know, if there's always going to be and always has been, or at least always has been, you know, a disparity in wealth that, you know, you don't have to be a king, you don't have to be a monarch anymore. You don't have to be, you know, attached to some of the institutions. And now someone like Jeff can come from sort of nowhere to ascend to that level, at least financial wealth.
I mean, we're all kind of kings, relatively speaking.
To the world, especially.
You know, not even relative now, but that's definitely true if you're in the US, but worldwide, not in all places, of course, but generally relative to 200 years ago, we're all a lot better off. And I hope that that continues. And there's certainly a cost that, you know, I do think like the environment is important. Like we've got one planet. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, technology probably plays a role in hopefully addressing that. or finding a backup planet, you know, if it can't be addressed, I don't know that, you know, people will consume less. You know, I hope that we consume smarter and kind of back to where, you know, AI can help is free up our problem solving capacity, you know, to think about like much bigger issues than, hey, I got to pay the rent this month. I mean, that's a big issue if the rent's past due. But, you know, I think if we can buy ourselves more time, that we can use the time that we have more in ways that have better impact.
Sure. Before we go, I'd like to get a little entrepreneurial wisdom. So to the startup folks that will inevitably be listening to this because of your track record, what are some of your lessons learned that you would like to pass on as far as being running a startup and asking for money and growing in the future?
Pick something that you're really, really passionate about. And you have to be, because if you ever compete with somebody who's really passionate about something that you're not as passionate about and you're competing with them, you're going to lose. So you're better off looking at it from the, what do I really love doing and what could I do even if I didn't get paid? And if you find the answer to that, there's probably a way to make your financial goals happen as well. And today, everybody kind of needs to be the best. There's no second anymore. There's millions of markets of dozens, and the dozen people want the very best for whatever they're buying. So I think we all have to kind of line up what we do well and what we enjoy doing personally and just put 100% into that and do what you love.
Cool. We finish every show with a shout out. So someone you think's doing some great work in Tampa Bay that you want to give a little attention to.
Oh, well, the Synapse team.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Synapse team and, you know, the Florida Funders team, I'm certainly biased. I have an office over there, so I see them, you know, working all the time, and they are working all the time. You know, they are very hard at work doing stuff that is creating amazing results for the community. And so for sure, I don't want to call out one person because there's so many people over there that are, you know, just really giving it their all. And just, you know, if you went, did you go last year?
I did. Yeah. We actually launched the St. Pete Catalyst last year.
Okay. So, you know, like, and that was year one.
We'll be back again this year.
I can't imagine what this year is going to be like, but they're doing a phenomenal job. And the stuff that Florida Funders is doing is, you know, I think really, really good stuff. And gosh, you could probably just sit 45 minutes listing all of the different cool things that are going on. But
shout out to Seed Funders too.
Seed Funders
taking
for sure.
Taking the baby spot there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I would say, you know, maybe I just remove Florida Funders, but the Seed Funders guys seeded Florida Funders. Yeah. You know, so.
And I think we're just in the midst of actually in our internal meetings, we talked about we'll prepare companies for Florida Funders. And our first investment just got approved for Florida Funders funding. So it's working.
It is absolutely working.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
I appreciate you having me here. I enjoyed it.
You made it to the end of another great episode. For show notes, head to stpete.co to the show notes page, which includes links to all the resources mentioned in the show, as well as quotes and key insights from the show and information about the guest and the host. Thanks again to our sponsor, Big C. Head to Big C, that's BIGSEA.co to check out their work. And if you like what you heard, make sure to share this episode on social media and leave a comment. See you next time.